From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, warning from the U.S. to Nigeria on their upcoming elections. Thousands fleeing Boko Haram threats. UN calling for Ebola recovery strategy, plus President Obama in India. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry visited Nigeria on Sunday in a show of the level of concern within the U.S. and the international community over next month's presidential election. Chris Stein reports.
Kerry came to Nigeria's sprawling commercial capital, Lagos, on Sunday to meet with President Goodluck Jonathan and his main challenger, former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari, ahead of next month's polls. Kerry's visit came on the same day Boko Haram militants attacked the capital of the northeastern Borno state, Maiduguri, the latest violent incident in its over five-year quest to impose strict Islamic law in the northeast. While Kerry expressed support for Nigeria in its fight against Boko Haram, he also warned officials in Nigeria about instigating any violence around the upcoming election, saying they would be denied entry into the U.S. if they did so.
It's absolutely critical that these elections be conducted peacefully, that they are credible, transparent, accountable, so that the people of Nigeria can have faith and the world can have faith in the government that flows from it.
Some Nigerians say they hope Kerry's visit will stop the polls from degenerating into bloodshed.
What we're hoping for is a free and fair and credible election. They should assist us. That's all we want.
Clement Nwankwo, executive director of the Policy and Legal Advocacy Center in the capital, Abuja, said Kerry's visit shows the U.S. believes the stakes are high.
The visit of the Secretary of State would emphasize that the international community is looking at what is going on in Nigeria. I think, of course, it means that the administration here would understand that the world is watching what is going on and would have to be measured in the way that it carries on.
Kerry also spoke with the head of Nigeria's Electoral Commission, urging him not to delay the polls scheduled for February 14th. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
And while Nigerian forces were able to repel Boko Haram's attempted attack on Maiduguri Sunday, just across the border in Cameroon, a recent attack apparently by Boko Haram is part of the reason why thousands of panic-stricken Cameroonians are fleeing the border with Nigeria for safer localities in the hinterlands. We go now to Cameroon's capital, where Moki Edwin Kinzika has our report.
32-year-old Lamsi Maimaina has just arrived at the Palace of the Lamido, traditional ruler of Red Buba in North Cameroon. She says she fled from Turu on Cameroon's border with Nigeria, where she had been living for 15 years, and came to Red Buba to tell her husband's parents that she had not seen him since the attack by suspected Boko Haram fighters. She says she just wants to give thanks to God, who has guided her to a safe zone, adding that she does not know where her family members are. She says some died in front of her and others cried in pain while she was able to escape. Wherever they are, she says she can only give thanks to God and hope to meet them one day. The Lamido of Red Buba, Abubakari Abdullahi, says he has been receiving hundreds of refugees from the border with Nigeria.
L'ensemble de nos populations sont sensibilisées. Nos populations sont solidaires.
He says all of his people have been educated on the need to work in solidarity with their suffering brothers and sisters. The Lamido says they have organized themselves and are receiving all the displaced people who, he adds, tell horrifying stories. But not all the people are ready to receive the strangers. Like Kinjo Amidu, a cattle rancher in Red Buba, says Cameroonians have to be sure that the people they are helping are not Boko Haram militants in disguise.
C'est là que je disais tout à l'heure qu'il faut bien filtrer
He says everyone who claims to be running from the war zone, even those who say they are our relatives, should not be accepted here without proper identification because no one knows their plans. Abubakari Abdullahi says he has taken all necessary precautions to stop a possible incursion by members of the terror group. The head of Cameroon's army, Lieutenant General René-Claude Meka, says some 10,000 Cameroonians have fled the border with Nigeria within the past 3 weeks. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, Yaoundé.
The African Union Summit is underway in Ethiopia's capital city, and Martha Vanderwolf is there. She spoke to the deputy chairman of the AU Commission about the key issues on the agenda of the summit.
Hundreds of meetings will be held within the next week in Addis Ababa. The official theme of the African Union Summit is women's empowerment and development. And among the topics that will most likely dominate are the fight against Ebola and elections in 2015. But as usual, peace and security issues such as the violent attacks from Nigerian militant group Boko Haram will top the agenda. Deputy Chairperson of the African Union Commission, Erastus Mwencha, says that further action depends on the requests from the regional countries during the summit.
If you look at the heinous crimes that are being committed by Boko Haram, if you see the extent to which it is now spreading its tentacles to other parts of the region beyond Nigeria, it calls for intervention. But that also rests on the countries they are requesting. And so that's why this matter must be discussed at the Union. If there is a request, then, of course, the African Union will intervene.
A special regional summit on South Sudan's conflict will also be held on the sidelines of the AU meeting, as little progress has been made so far in halting the violent conflict. The East African bloc IGAD has been mediating the process. IGAD will present a report, and based on that, further action will be taken next week. Meanwhile, current protests in the Democratic Republic of the Congo broke out after the president there was seen to be trying to change the maximum term limit. With more than 10 elections on the continent this year, Mwencha says the AU is involved in trying to ensure peaceful elections.
We try to make sure that we have long-term observers on the ground to help member states address some of the challenges that could frustrate having a free and fair outcome of an election, but also a mechanism that could enable the parties to dialogue to make sure that such a conflict doesn't happen. And we do intervene on that constantly.
Ebola was one of the major crises on the continent last year, and assessing the responsiveness to the Ebola outbreak will be a significant agenda point, says Mwencha.
This is, of course, a new dimension in the social sector. And the lessons learned, of course, having capacity for preparedness, response mechanisms and structures, is extremely informative.
The African Union Summit will be concluded with a two-day heads of state meeting Friday and Saturday of next week. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
World Health Organization has acknowledged its delayed response to the Ebola epidemic. WHO Director General Margaret Chan, speaking Sunday in Geneva, was responding to criticism the UN Health Agency's response was slow and reform of its crisis management approach was needed.
The Ebola outbreak reveals some inadequacies, shortcomings in this organization's administrative, managerial, and technical infrastructures. The Ebola outbreak points to the need for urgent change in three main areas: to rebuild and strengthen national and international emergency preparedness and response, to address the way new medical products are brought to market, and to strengthen the way WHO operates during emergencies.
Resolution adopted at the end of the emergency session of the WHO called for creation of an emergency fund to fight future epidemics that Dr. Chan hopes will start at $100 million. Other measures include faster recruitment and deployment of frontline workers, development of quality, safe, and effective, as well as affordable vaccines and treatments, and streamlining and strengthening the WHO's response with the naming of a special representative to oversee the Ebola fight. The Secretary General of the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, Jerome Overwright, was critical of the WHO's handling of the crisis.
It's very little, very late in view of where we are 10 months after the outbreak started. And what's very worrying for an organization like Médecins Sans Frontières is a huge reliance on what is essentially a private organization with very limited means to actually deal with an epidemic of scale of international proportions. And therefore, there is really a need not just to look at Ebola, but look further afield in terms of how we can learn and better respond. And again, when taking lessons, we should look beyond Ebola to really look at the past decade, how we've responded to epidemics, even such as cholera or measles over the past decade. I think the focus should not just be on WHO, it should really be on member states to actually take their responsibility vis-a-vis the United Nations. It is them at the end of the day which can be driving the next response, the how it's organized, what the role of states, what the support to national governments, but also how WHO can be resourced to actually face the future, but also is organized to face the future.
WHO's Margaret Chan says Ebola cases in the three worst affected West African countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, are on the decline, and said the momentum must be maintained and warned against complacency and donor fatigue. In addition to dealing with complacency and donor fatigue, plans have to be made now for the recovery of those countries affected by the Ebola outbreak. Joint Mission has just completed its assessment in Sierra Leone. And VOA's Joe DiCapua has the story.
The UN Development Program led the mission in Sierra Leone. It included representatives of the World Bank, the African Development Bank, the EU, and other UN agencies. David McLaughlin Carr is the UN resident coordinator.
The purpose was to try and work in a coordinated fashion towards gauging the socioeconomic impacts of Ebola on Sierra Leone. This country has taken a very hard hit. And Ebola itself, I think, has exposed a number of the structural weaknesses that need urgent attention by the international community.
The mission has assessed how Ebola battered Sierra Leone's economy.
Growth in 2013 was predicted to be about 11%. 2014, we think overall it will be about 4%. And in 2015, it could be less than 2%. That itself will tell you just what an enormous impact Ebola has had across the economy as a whole. Investment has basically dried up as companies have left the country, fearing, of course, contagion.
McLaughlin Carr says the Ebola outbreak crippled agriculture and mining, two big revenue sources for Sierra Leone, and two sectors providing livelihoods for many families. The mission has identified key areas for recovery, including infrastructure and basic services, sanitation, and health.
Health, of course, is absolutely fundamental to not only getting over Ebola, but also for the future development of this country. That sector really needs a lot of support at a structural level. There are systemic problems in terms of the lack of doctors and nurses, the lack of hospitals, the lack of, shall we say, local health clinics. And these are going to have to be addressed, I think, very aggressively.
McLaughlin Carr says very large parts of Sierra Leone lack access to clean water and latrines. That creates breeding grounds for mosquitoes and increases the risk of malaria.
Then, of course, there's the education sector. About 25% of children, even before Ebola, were not even in the school system. We need to, in a way, reset the agenda on education and have serious discussions to ensure that this country doesn't go backwards on the literacy gains of the past decade, but also can ensure that there's more inclusive education across the sectors.
The UN mission also recommends improvements in governance.
There are inefficiencies, there are accountability and transparencies that we need to build into service delivery in this country, and we'll be working very seriously with the government about having a conversation on how the UN system and the international community can support public sector reform in order to ensure that social services not only decentralized, but actually really deliver on the services they're meant to provide to the people.
The UNDP official also says the private sector has a huge role to play in Sierra Leone's recovery, but that requires restoring investor confidence in the country. A recovery strategy could be in place in a few months, but he says that depends on how much progress has been made against Ebola. In December, about 500 new cases were being reported each week. It's much lower now.
We're not out of the woods yet. We're still having in the vicinity of 100 to 200 cases per week, which is far too many. Disease as contagious as Ebola, one case is too many. We still have a major health crisis on our hands, which needs to be brought under control as quickly as possible.
The UN Development Program says poverty and environmental degradation helped worsen the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone. The UNDP is also conducting assessment missions in Guinea and Liberia. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And updating the Ebola numbers, World Health Organization says more than 8,600 lives have been lost to the disease, with more than 21,700 known cases.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
President Obama and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi have announced progress in the impasse over implementing a landmark civilian nuclear deal that was signed in 2008. That breakthrough came during Mr. Obama's visit to India as the first American president to attend the country's Republic Day celebrations today. VOA's Arup Pandey has more from New Delhi.
The India-U.S. nuclear deal, first agreed to in 2005, was hailed as a turning point in relations between the two countries, allowing India for the first time to obtain civilian nuclear energy to provide electricity to millions of its people without access to power. But years later, there had been no real movement on the deal due to concerns from American companies they'll be held liable in the event of a nuclear accident, and India objecting to the United States wanting to track the nuclear material. Following talks Sunday with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in New Delhi, President Barack Obama cited progress in making the deal a reality.
Today we achieved a breakthrough understanding on two issues that were holding up our ability to advance our civil nuclear cooperation, and we're committed to moving towards full implementation. And this is an important step that shows how we can work together to elevate our relationship.
The American leader's trip aims to build on what White House officials have called regained momentum in the U.S.-India relationship. Sunday began with President Obama and his wife Michelle receiving a warm welcome from Prime Minister Modi, who departed from protocol to greet the American leader with a hug. Then there was a ceremonial welcome at the presidential palace, followed by a wreath laying at a memorial for Mahatma Gandhi, before President Obama sat down for talks with Prime Minister Modi. Aside from extending a defense cooperation deal for another 10 years, both leaders pledged to work together to fight climate change. Prime Minister Modi said India is not under pressure from a deal the United States and China reached late last year to cut carbon emissions.
Bharat ek swatantra desh hai. Us par na kisi desh ka, na kisi vyakti ka pressure kaam aata hai.
But, he said, there is pressure. When we think about the future generations and what kind of world we are going to give them, then there is pressure. He said climate change itself is a huge pressure. Their press briefing ended with both leaders acknowledging the forging of a personal friendship. That rapport and chemistry was evident as Prime Minister Modi reciprocated the personal tour he received of the Martin Luther King Memorial just 4 months earlier in Washington. The leaders of the world's two largest democracies took a stroll alone through the garden and talked over tea. Arup Pandey, VOA News, New Delhi.
Also in the news, thousands flocked to the streets of Athens on Sunday evening to celebrate the Syriza party's victory in national elections and cheer for its leader, Alexis Tsipras. Addressing several thousand strong, carrying flags, waving, supporters shedding tears of joy, Tsipras claimed a mandate to overturn the painful austerity policies imposed on Athens by international creditors. Some observers believe Tsipras's political party might have to form a coalition government, but it appears the government of incumbent Prime Minister Antanas Samaras is on its way out. Tsipras has promised to renegotiate a deal with the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, and write off Greece's 320 billion euro debt, which at more than 175% of gross domestic product is the world's second highest after Japan. New round of talks between the rival Libyan factions is planned in Geneva. In a new push, the UN mission in Libya says two rounds of talks will take place this week in Switzerland. And on Sunday, gunmen kidnapped a Libyan deputy foreign minister, Hassan al-Saghir, from his hotel room in the eastern city of Albaida. A ministry official said the kidnappers told staff they were members of the security forces when they entered the hotel from dawn. No group immediately claimed responsibility.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The slaughter of rhinos in South Africa is growing worse with each passing year, a fact that became clear this week when the government said a record number of rhinos were poached in 2014. Killings continue unabated despite what the government describes as intense efforts to stop poachers. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
Even South Africa's normally upbeat environmental affairs minister could not sugarcoat the grim news. 2014 was a veritable slaughter for the nation's rhinos. Minister Edna Molewa spoke to journalists in Pretoria, South Africa's capital.
During 2014, we said to say this, a number of 1,215 rhinos were killed. This is a rise in the number of poached rhino from 1,004 in 2013. This is indeed very worrying.
That's a 21% increase from 2013, which until now was the worst year on record. The World Wildlife Fund estimates that South Africa is home to about 20,000 rhinos. That's more than 80% of the world's rhino population. South Africa's Kruger National Park is home to about half of the nation's rhinos. The animals are hunted for their horn, which is prized in Asia as traditional medicine, though there is no scientific evidence it has any effect. The horn is composed entirely of keratin, the same substance as human hair and nails. Molewa also noted a rise in the number of arrests of suspected poachers to 386. But conservationists say that once suspects are arrested, they often fall through the cracks of South Africa's notoriously inefficient legal system. Molewa said it's clear that more needs to be done, and said South Africa is going to extreme lengths to protect rhinos. One measure, she said, is the relocation of animals to secret locations in neighboring countries.
Now, in the last quarter, which was last year, 2014, 56 rhino have already been moved out of poaching hotspots and translocated from certain areas within the Kruger National Park to what we call an intensive protection zone, IPZs, as well as to other more secure areas. And over and above that, approximately 100 rhino have been translocated to neighboring states in the SADC region during 2014.
She said another 200 rhinos will be relocated this year. But Joe Shaw, WWF's rhino program manager, told VOA News via Skype that more needs to be done.
It's obviously extremely worrying news. We're talking about a loss of 100 rhinos a month or more than three a day. We really need to see strategic, concerted action, not just at a national level, but internationally, to bring the criminal syndicates who are responsible for these deaths to book.
WWF described 2015 as a make-or-break year for South Africa's rhinos. Conservationists and governments will next have a chance to discuss this issue in March at the Intergovernmental Conference on Illegal Wildlife Trade in Botswana. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And one last item, a U.S. Space Agency probe is to start photographing Pluto to prepare itself for a historic encounter, which will happen in July. The New Horizons spacecraft has traveled 5 billion kilometers over 9 years to get near Pluto, and with 200 million kilometers still to go, its images of Pluto will show just a speck of light against the stars. But the data will be critical in helping to align the probe properly for that fleeting flyby in July. Pluto will be photographed repeatedly during the approach to determine the probe's position relative to the dwarf planet. The closest approach to Pluto is set to happen at around 11:50 Universal Time on July the 14th, at a distance roughly 13,695 kilometers from the surface. Yeah, that's how I like to fly by, a few thousand kilometers away. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America. It's always good to have you with us for International Edition. World News, straight ahead. Stay tuned for our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On January 26, 1564, the Pope issued a bull or charter confirming decisions made by the Council of Trent, which clarified Roman Catholic doctrine and condemned Protestantism. On this day in 1788, British Captain Arthur Phillip, commanding a fleet of 11 ships carrying some 700 convicts, established the first European settlement in New South Wales. The anniversary is a national holiday in Australia. In 1880, American General Douglas MacArthur was born. MacArthur fought in three major wars and rose to the rank of five-star general in the U.S. Army. He oversaw the surrender of Japan at the end of World War II and presided over its occupation. He was relieved of his duties when he openly questioned President Truman's policies. In 1924, the city of Petrograd in the Soviet Union was renamed Leningrad after the founder of communism. In 1991, there was another change when the city reverted to its historic name, St. Petersburg. On this day in 1950, the Indian Constitution took effect, making India the most populous democracy in the world. In 1998, U.S. President Bill Clinton looked into a TV camera and denied having had sexual relations with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. He later admitted that he had indeed had an affair with a young woman. Mr. Clinton eventually faced impeachment by Congress stemming from his relationship with Lewinsky. In 2004, Afghan President Hamid Karzai signed a new constitution for his country. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A top leader of the ruthless armed group that for decades has terrorized a large area of Central Africa is now in custody of an international tribunal to face charges for war crimes and crimes against humanity. The United States welcomes Dominic Ongwen's transfer to the International Criminal Court as an important step toward justice for victims of the Lord's Resistance Army. Ongwen, 34, defected from the LRA in early January. In announcing his transfer to the ICC, the United Nations Security Council called on states to bring the group's remaining commanders to justice, including its leader, Joseph Kony. And the UN urged an immediate end to all attacks by the LRA, release of all those abducted, and its fighters to disarm and demobilize. Abducted as a child, Ongwen allegedly went on to commit and direct brutal crimes over many years as one of the group's senior commanders, including attacks on displaced civilians in northern Uganda, and the massacre of more than 300 civilians in Makombo, Democratic Republic of the Congo, by elements reportedly under his command. We commend the efforts of all those involved in Ongwen's transfer, including the African Union Anti-LRA Task Force, for its significant efforts that laid the groundwork for Ongwen's removal from the battlefield, President Museveni and the government of Uganda for their sustained leadership in the regional efforts to end the LRA threat, and the Central African Republic's transitional president, Catherine Samba Panza, whose actions have exemplified her deep commitment to ending impunity in the CAR and ensuring that the perpetrators of atrocities are held accountable. We also thank those individuals in the CAR whose actions made it possible for Ongwen to face justice, and we call on all citizens of LRA-affected areas to continue their efforts to support the forces combating the LRA in the region. These developments give hope to the survivors, to the four countries affected by the LRA, and to their partners around the world, that the nightmare of the LRA can be brought to an end.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email,
visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.